On the program today, the banking challenge yet to come. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the 27th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One treads not lightly into the land of, hey, it could get worse, you know, especially not with some degree of banking uncertainty still in the air. But on the theory that the more you know, the more you know, it is time to dig a little deeper into what regional banks actually do in this economy. And other than in some relatively specific markets, like, say, taking deposits from and making loans to high-tech startups, a lot of what regional and community banks do is commercial real estate lending. Now, the direct banking stresses we have seen of late seem to be calming down somewhat, emphasis on seems. But if another proverbial shoe is going to drop, it might well be the dress shoes you are no longer wearing to the office. Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going.
Okay, so before you go stuffing your money into your mattress or shoebox or Bitcoin derivatives or something, all the commercial real estate and banking experts I talked to today did not say the sky is falling. There's just some reasons to worry.
The banks have $270 billion of commercial real estate loans coming due this year. By our estimate, about $80 billion of that is in the office space, which we're extra concerned about.
Matt Anderson is managing director at TREP, Inc., which tracks commercial real estate. Now, a good chunk of that debt is owed to the giant too-big-to-fail banks, but they've got other lines of business they can rely on.
Regional and smaller banks tend to be more loan-heavy in the first place, and commercial real estate even more so.
Office building owners typically would just refinance that $80 billion they owe. But Thomas Piskorski at Columbia Business School says refinancing is not a very attractive option right now. Interest rates are really high. And
currently, these office buildings are worth much less than when these loans were issued.
Office occupancy rates are at about 50% in major cities, according to the office key card company Castle. If office building owners start missing payments or going into foreclosure,
the banks at some point would have to recognize these losses, which would put their capital position in an even worse position than it currently is.
Yes, that sounds scary. But late payments actually aren't up all that much so far this year. And Kevin Fagan at Moody's says regional banks and other lenders have been much pickier about who to give money to.
They can weather the storm for a while. It needs to be an extreme permanent kind of drop.
Fagan says it's too early to be having financial crisis deja vu. But he says you can't expect banks of all sizes to be even more tight with their lending. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Just to close the books, as it were, on Silicon Valley Bank. Technically, it was Silicon Valley Bridge Bank after the FDIC took it over a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, its deposits and loans have been sold to First Citizens Bank shares out of North Carolina. First Citizens investors liked it a whole lot. Shares up 53% today. Elsewise, on Wall Street, a little up, a little down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is going to be a week for federal banking regulators. People from the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, and the FDIC are going to be on Capitol Hill for committee hearings in the Senate on Tuesday, the House on Wednesday. And there are sure to be some pointed, shall we say, questions from lawmakers. But those regulators are also going to have something of a PR job to do, convince the markets and the American public that everything is going to be okay. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Banking regulators want everyone to just calm down, especially depositors at smaller banks who've been pulling their money out lately to the tune of $120 billion the week after Silicon Valley Bank failed. Sean Neary is with communications firm Edelman Smithfield and says officials need to get a few messages across.
that the system has worked, that they have had the ability to step in when necessary and communicate the actions that they have taken to rectify and repair the system.
Because even though SVB's customers didn't lose a penny,
there still is, even to this day, a lack of confidence.
And that lack of confidence could turn into another crisis if fear takes over. Anusha Chari is a professor of economics and finance at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She, like many experts watching all this go down, doesn't think it's time to go stash your cash in the mattress.
There's definitely been a big hiccup, but as far as the overall banking system is concerned, I do think that SVB was an outlier. And my belief is that the overall trust in the banking system continues to remain high, except for these pockets of vulnerability.
But if you're still worried, maybe you should go talk to a therapist, like financial therapist Dr. Megan McCoy at Kansas State University.
Understanding that if you're experiencing anxiety, it's probably from a whole bunch of experiences you've had over the last couple of years. And tackling those other things head on will really help alleviate any stress and worry you have today.
So instead of running to the bank to take out all your money, what you might need is more of a financial mental health break. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Shanghai, China, population 25 million or so, is one of the key cities in the second biggest economy in the world. It is certainly that country's financial center. It's got the stock market and the banks and a whole lot of the wealth, but it's also a place for people to see and be seen. So a year ago today, when Shanghai was put on 24 hours notice of a hard lockdown to try and stop a surge in COVID cases, that was a global economic story. What had been announced as an 8-day shutdown wound up dragging on for more than 2 months. So a year later, Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has spent some time on what Shanghai is doing to recover.
Shanghai is known for being a good place for international businesses. The European Union has a chamber of commerce with 620 members in Shanghai, where Bettina Schoenbihanzin is the chair.
We have here the biggest port. It's easy to access the government authorities. You get very fast and efficient service. You have a lot of very professional, well-educated talents.
And through most of the pandemic, COVID restrictions here were lighter compared to those in other Chinese cities. That's how Ohio native Josh Vaughn was able to launch a business in 2021. Over a Mexican meal, he says, back then, Shanghai was still hosting open-air markets, where he'd sell his sunglasses made from recycled and sustainable materials.
We came in hot, and for every pair that we sell, we remove a pound of plastic from the ocean. We were doing like 5-6 hour markets, and we were removing like 50-60 pounds of plastic from doing an event.
That momentum went out the door last year in March when the highly infectious Omicron variant hit Shanghai. Officials pledged never to mandate a citywide lockdown. Barely a day later, they did. Contemporary artist Jin Shan was shocked.
I was very surprised that a city of over 20 million people could be shut down all of a sudden. How did we get food or see doctors? Those were the biggest challenges. I'm surprised I survived that.
People survived largely because of hardworking and entrepreneurial delivery folks like Wang Shiwei.
I created group chats at different residential blocks. People would say what groceries they wanted. I tried to find which shops were open and helped them deliver.
Once Wang Shiwei left his home, he wasn't allowed to return and slept in his minivan. Finance and factory workers also slept at their workplaces, but they never knew for how long. Again, the EU Chamber of Commerce's Bettina Schoenbihanzin.
We had to live with very erratic decisions, high level of unpredictability, and this eroded for sure a lot of trust.
And there's still a lot of trauma. During the lockdown, some people were forced to separate from their young children. Family pets were killed. If you were sick or exposed, you could be sent to a quarantine camp. That happened to entrepreneur Josh Vaughn.
Yeah, I was quarantined. I was sent to a hotel. Then I got sent to a hospital.
I mean, could you at least summarize, like, the word you would describe what that was like?
Unpleasant.
And that's an understatement. But like many in the city, he prefers to leave the lockdown behind. Today, Shanghai appears back to normal. The subway is packed, malls are busy, but the financial hub is a little less international. Again, the EU Chamber of Commerce's Bettina Schoen behind Zine.
About 25% of the German community left the city post-lockdown, and a 20% decrease in the number of French and Italian nationals.
There are still reasons for foreigners to stay, says entrepreneur Josh Vaughn.
China is still like number one in manufacturing.
And for Chinese nationals like courier Wang Shiwei from central China, Shanghai is still the best place to make money.
There aren't many job opportunities in my hometown. Shanghai's consumption is bigger, which means I can earn more here.
And art and the economy are intricately linked, says artist Jin Shan. He couldn't create during the lockdown, but he's starting to make sculptures again.
I'm still anxious, but time will make that memory fade.
He says the faster the economy rebounds, the more confident people will be about Shanghai as a place to both live and work. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you can send data and it prints the Bible. You send data, it prints Brothers Karamazov.
You send data and it prints a hypercar? Yeah, maybe. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 194 today, 0.6%, 32,432. The NASDAQ gave up 55 points, about 0.5%, 11,768. The S&P 500 up 6, bit under 0.2% there, 39.77. A wave of relief flowed through the regional banking sector after First Citizen Bank shares acquired the outstanding loans and deposits, as I said, of Silicon Valley Bank. Fifth Third Bank Corp grew 3.1%. First Republic rose just shy of 12%. First Republic, I probably should have said troubled First Republic, right? Zions Bank Corporation grew 3.8%. Big banks got a boost as well. J.P. Morgan Chase ascended almost 2.9%. Morgan Stanley added about 0.8%. Checking in on some of the bigger players in commercial real estate that Matt Levin was telling us about. CBRA Group expanded 0.75%. Realty Income Corporation, lots of single-tenant retail spaces there. Think drug and dollar stores, contracted a little over 0.5%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, up to 3.54%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This economy is changing. A lot of that is because of the pandemic, how we work, where a lot of us work, and the kinds of jobs there are. But the infrastructure of this economy, manufacturing, is changing too. Literally the nuts and bolts of it, and it has been for a while, thanks in part to technology and the ability to do things differently. And it's changing a lot.
It's literally like saying in the typewriter era, I'm about to create a desktop system.
Kevin Zinger is the founder and CEO of two companies, Zinger Vehicles and Divergent Technologies, that are trying to lead the way in that change. I met him the other day at their production facility in Torrance, where step one is making supercars. Oh, there it is. The one we're looking at, the Zinger 21C, has a base price of $2 million.
It is cobalt blue, super shiny, looks like a rocket ship.
And it basically is a rocket ship. So this is a car which its competitor peers are the Mercedes AMG 1 hypercar.
McLaren, people will know the McLaren.
McLaren,
right?
As well. Last year at the Circuit of the Americas, yeah, and at Laguna Seca, this car shattered the production track records set by McLaren at both tracks.
The first 80 of them will be ready for customers later this year. And yes, most of us aren't in the market for a $2 million supercar, but put that out of your mind for a second, because I'm here for this.
What I'm trying to do is create a machine that takes manufacturing, which is still stuck in 100-year-old plus technologies, into the digital age.
It is an accident of history that you're doing cars as your attempt to change manufacturing in this economy, right? You're a Cleveland guy. Your brothers worked at dealerships as mechanics. You've been cars your whole life.
Sure.
Had you not been from there, it could have been something else, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I obviously, I've worked on cars all my life. At the same time, we only need to look out our window and we see the entire built human environment is built around cars, parking lots, streets. And if we're actually going to do something environmentally and economically that makes sense, we need to solve that major problem.
Show me how you're going to solve it.
Okay. So the first thing is the digital design of these structures.
All right, wait. So what is this guy doing with these lasers here on this thing? What is that? Is that part of the whole process? That's part of the whole process.
Right now, this is checking dimensions of this door.
Yeah.
That's being done by hand. For the structures, we use this system here. And what this is doing is automatically scanning and checking the dimensions.
The system has three parts: design, manufacture, and assembly. The design is done with the help of artificial intelligence. Super specialized 3D printers make the structures that he's talking about. And the assembly is done by a team of robots.
3D printing is one piece of an overall system.
You are design agnostic, right? You happen to be doing cars now.
Sure.
But if you get this right, this scales to all kinds of other manufacturing.
I'd say it scales to, you know, certainly air, land, and sea vehicles, but then it starts to become a way to digitally design. So already on this assembly system we have here, we're already designing and printing parts of the assembly system that you see right there using the system itself.
Sorry, wait. That's a little high concept. You're designing and printing part of the system that's going to design and print.
Of course.
You say that like that's not amazing.
Do this for 8 years of 80 to 100-hour weeks, and you're so into everything that it is what it's been planned to be. And if you wanted to leap ahead 20 years, you know what you want to have? You want to have a globe filled with localized manufacturing where there's no barrier to entry to people that want to create useful products. And the only way you have a permanent manufacturing footprint is if the system redesigns itself into its next version right there.
We should be clear when you're talking about a localized footprint, right? I mean, we're in a factory and it's, you know, it's a 21st century factory. It's very clean, lots of robots, all that jazz. But factories as we think of them in this economy, or have thought of them for decades, are ginormous. Think River Rouge, think the GM plant in Shanghai, right? I mean, they're incredibly space resource and personnel intensive. That doesn't seem to be the vibe here.
No. Digital manufacturing flips all of that on its head. It says you do things flexibly, locally, and in a modular way, right? Like we have a desktop computer. You don't have to have hundreds of printing presses printing different books. You can send data and it prints the Bible. You send data, it prints Brothers Karamazov.
Right.
That is the fundamental difference.
So let's take a walk around this central hub here, and we should say it's a big glass enclosure with, is that like 12 assembly machines? 15 maybe?
So what you're seeing here in this octagonal design is a set of robots where any set of perfectly designed building blocks come in with their instruction set.
So that's the thing where you were just talking. You can send data and have it print the Bible. You can send data and have it print the Brothers Karamazov. You can send data here and have it print the fancy supercar, or eventually you could send data here and have it print, I don't even know what.
Well, this has, or assemble, this has whatever. Printed, this is an assembly cell,
but
this has assembled back-to-back sports car, luxury SUV parts, and a drone. Back to back to back to back with zero switch over time.
Other than the challenge of trying to change manufacturing as we know it,
What's your biggest headache?
Obviously, our financial system and venture capital are designed to finance quick cash generation software applications.
Right.
Rather than someone saying, I'm going to do from scratch the digital design, manufacture, and assembly for all vehicle structures.
Right.
That is a challenge.
They can't see you now, but there's a little smirk on your face. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge, for sure.
Let me ask you the labor force question. And I talked earlier about your brothers, your older brothers who grew up as mechanics at
dealership, car mechanics, Bigelow Chevy, and
exactly.
Cleveland.
Could they get a job here working for their little brother?
Absolutely. No, there are jobs that are overseeing the operations and maintenance of the machines. What I would say is, when people ask me the question, will this wipe out auto factory jobs, which is the question you're really asking.
Yeah.
If you go to a modern auto factory, as you probably have, Kai, you'll see that, you have these quarter to half mile long lines where there are no workers there. What we do is we replace the cost and expense of building those Leviathan factories with all of their capital risk. We replace that with something that's much more flexible. And all of those general assembly jobs where you're putting in the interior and the powertrain, those, we don't touch those. So it actually makes any automotive factory in the West stronger and more competitive without taking away any general assembly jobs.
Kevin, thanks a lot.
Okay.
The federal funds rate, that's the one we talk about all the time. It's the one the Federal Reserve controls, is the highest it's been since 2007. That affects all parts of this economy, mortgages, as we've been seeing for a while now. And finally, a year something into this rate raising cycle, it's hitting consumer banking. The rates we get for the money we let our banks use. Case in point, certificates of deposit. Some banks are offering CDs at nearly 5%, but coming off a time when interest rates were really low for really long, banks might have to explain to their customers what CDs are in the first place. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes does that explaining for us today.
University of Chicago economist Damon Jones was in college when he learned what a CD was.
But I didn't have any money, so I couldn't really act on it.
I was a teenager, also with no money. And honestly, I thought a CD was a thing used for music. But in the financial world,
it is easier to explain a CD than some other investments because there's just a percentage rate.
Banks offer to keep your money for a set period of time in a CD, usually 6 months to 5 years. And the interest rate that each bank offers depends on how much that bank needs your money.
The more they need it, the more they'll probably pay for it.
Merrill J. Reynolds is a banking industry consultant and on the faculty of Southern Methodist University.
When banks get all this cash in, the idea is to make money on that cash. The easiest way to make money on that cash is to turn around and lend it out.
So if you agree to put your money into a CD for 1 year with an interest rate of 5%, that same bank might turn around and lend someone else the money to buy a house at a higher interest rate, say 6.5%. The difference?
That's called the spread.
And rates offered for CDs vary a lot by institution. Herman Chan researches regional banks as a senior equity analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
The largest U.S. banks, they're not really playing the game as much as some of the smaller regionals. Really, the fact is that the largest banks are really awash in deposits, right?
CDs offer all banks a kind of stability, says financial risk consultant Mayra Rodriguez-Valladares.
They want more people in certificates of deposits because then individuals are a lot less likely to withdraw their money.
Withdraw their money early, that is.
Because that usually comes with a penalty.
According to the Federal Reserve, the amount invested in large CDs, that is accounts with $100,000 or more, has gone up nearly 44% in the past year. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes to us via the World Bank, which has a new draft report out today that's not really great news global economy-wise. I saw this on Axios. The World Bank says the planet's potential economic growth over the next decade is just 2.2%. I say just because that's the lowest estimate of how much the global economy is going to be capable of growing in 30 years. Why the low potential, you ask? A whole lot of long-standing problems, labor force challenges, barriers to international trade, also slow productivity, all of them made worse by the aftermath of the pandemic and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. All right, we are going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Actually, it's more like a moment of economic, Jordan Holman, who you hear on this program on Fridays, had a story in the New York Times today about Crocs, the, as she puts it, aesthetically questionable but easily slipped on clogs. Crocs shares, Jordan pointed out, up 167% since January of 2020. Annual sales, they've increased 200%. Since 2019. Again, I say, Our daily production team includes, Daily production team includes Libby Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guillong, Maria Honhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.